It's the story, stupid. Welcome to the second part of the interview with Orson Scott Card. This was actually the first part I recorded. It is Orson Scott Card, myself, and Ed Schubert, the new editor of Intergalactic Medicine Show. While recording both of them, the volumes were a little funky, so I hope you hear everything okay, and without further ado, enjoy the interview.
I'm here with Orson Scott Card and Ed Schubert. You are taking over as the editor.
That's correct. Has taken over.
Has taken over.
Yes,
he is the editor.
I remain editor-in-chief, but editor-in-chief is a euphemism for a guy who never had time to do the job decently and is going to now start taking credit for what Ed does. But no, Ed is the responsible editor on this, with the caveat that every now and then I can insert a story that I fall in love with. But the truth is, if I fall in love with it, Ed's going to like it too. This is going to be a great story. So,
of course,
I have confidence that we'll all be happy with the result.
So, Professor, my first question on IGMS is just that over the last 20 years, and you touched on this some day in class, is that the short story market has really changed. There's not a lot of those markets for short stories out there. And how do you think the rise of the e-zine is going to affect that market? Do you think it's going to fill in some of those gaps?
Well, I sure hope so. I hope that the internet allows us to offer things cheaper. But the real problem is the audience for the short story has dried up. There aren't as many people who are eager to get a short story. And science fiction was one of the last to go. It used to be that short stories were the television. They did the job that television does. But with science fiction and fantasy, maybe because there was no really good science fiction television. You know, people would watch Star Trek episodes 1,000 times because there was nothing else to watch. And the short stories were giving them cool new stuff. And maybe it's dying because television's finally giving us good stuff. And I say finally because I don't think Star Trek was it, ever. It was for some people, but not enough to replace the hunger for the truly innovative thinking. But we've got some series that are doing interesting things, and enough different ones that maybe the hunger is drying up and going away, and that's why the magazines have dropped to something like a fifth of what their circulation used to be, or less.
Okay. What do you see as the future for Intergalactic Medicine Show? Under your tenure and yours?
Well, my tenure, the future was a lot of disgruntled writers whose stories weren't getting responded to because I was still busy doing the stuff that pays the bills for Intergalactic Medicine Show because it doesn't make money yet. You know, if there's a certain threshold we have to reach in order to be profitable, and we haven't reached it. But to do that, we have to make it urgent to read this. We have to make it so that people really want to read it and need to read it. And how do we do that? You know, how do we do that, Ed? That's an idea.
Well, this is a conversation that you and I have already had. I mean, just fill it up with great stories so that people will talk about it. And I think that's one of the things, that's one of the areas where you and I really see eye to eye, is that let's make it about great stories and great characters and forget about this business about writers writing for writers. I think a lot of what has hurt, especially the short story market, is just that people aren't writing to tell a story to a larger population. They're writing a story to impress other writers. And the art of storytelling is not the same thing as the art of writing. And storytelling seems to be kind of getting lost. And I'm really hoping that we can bring that back and make that the emphasis of Intergalactic Medicine Show.
But let me be the devil's advocate here. What a lot of people would say is that hunger is being satisfied by television, by movies, by the increasing number of good science fiction. For such a long time, there was no good science fiction on film. But now, we're getting some, and the Sci-Fi Channel is feeding a lot of that day-to-day hunger. If you're really dying for sci-fi stories, you'll go to those sources, and so all that's left for short stories is to please other writers, which is a much smaller market. We've got to get used to it, because that's all there is. I hope that's wrong. I hope that's not true.
I think if enough people, if the Sci-Fi Channel and these other shows become a big enough hit, that it potentially could bring in people who might not have exposed themselves to science fiction otherwise, that they might not have started with it, but if they find a TV show that they like, they might want to pursue it further.
I hope you're right. I mean, we look at Star Trek, and Star Trek really didn't help fiction. It created Star Trek fiction. And, you know, most of these series now, they start fiction set in that universe, so people keep repeating that universe. They want, you know, and the appeal of short stories in science fiction was they were all different. We kept going into new world after new world, and we had readers who are looking for new experiences. And that's still who we're looking for with IGMS, with Orson Scott Card's Intergalactic Medicine Show. Every now and then we've got to say the whole name. And online, it's OSC IGMS, because IGMS just gets you this random places trying to, collect money from me by getting me to buy the names in them, so forget that. We'll use the OSC IGMS.
Or just Intergalactic Medicine Show.
That works for me. Does that work? Yeah.
You can type that in.
Okay. You can type the whole
sucker. Fingers last.
Or link from our link on the website, on HatRec. Now I forget where we were going. That's the way that
Star Trek.
The Star Trek, okay. Because they created nothing of readership. In fact, they took over the science fiction conventions, became their own cons. But the con that was left behind was smaller. It's as if instead of bringing readers to science fiction, they took readers away from it. Or maybe the readership was shrinking anyway. Maybe what we were seeing was the self-identified readership was shrinking. That is, science fiction may have permeated the culture so much now that people don't really think of it as being a separate thing. People will go see iRobot without thinking, I'm watching science fiction. They think, I'm watching a Will Smith movie, and it happens to be in space, or it happens to be in the future with robots. It's a thriller, and that's what they're looking for, because when you think about it, a lot of people who pass themselves off as mainstream writers are tossing science fiction tropes into their work without effort, without it being a big deal.
Sure, Crichton is famous for that.
Yeah, well, Crichton's always done that, yeah.
Part of the problem, though, is that in a lot of areas, science fiction is viewed as sort of being juvenile. It's not viewed as an adult thing, and a lot of writers, Vonnegut famously, intentionally distance themselves from the title of science fiction writer, and that certainly doesn't help. But let me ask you this question, and I'll put it this way. If you're seeing Star Trek as ultimately having taken readers away from science fiction and taken people out of the conventions, if that is potentially going to happen again with all the shows that are out now of all times would you launch a new magazine?
Because I hope I'm wrong about those things. I mean, those ideas are there, and I think, wow, that might be true. But just because I thought of it doesn't mean it's right. It doesn't mean it's true. But I'm hoping that the science fiction short story can revive. And these things go in cycles, too. There's a lot of repetition. A lot of science fiction televisions, you go, well, I've seen that. And the answer is, because you feel like you've seen it because you have. It is nothing new. What you're getting is the same art direction, not taking you into a new place. But what I think really has to evolve is that science fiction short stories have to go into places where film can't go, where the budgets won't let them go, or where the experiences are not visual. Now, it's not just the thrill of seeing this cool new technology. I mean, we live surrounded by cool new technologies. We're all using MP3 players and carrying whole libraries of music with us. And, I've got 1,000 or 2 albums on every computer I carry around so that I can have this whole selection of classical and Brazilian and all kinds of different country music, especially. So that I can listen to whatever I'm in the mood for. And I love country music. You don't have to. And so, new technologies are not thrilling. So what we need is fiction that can take us places where we didn't go. Science fiction has long been the only place where religious fiction survived. I'm not talking about fiction that's, aren't we all glad we're Christians together, but fiction that really examines core religious, ethical, moral dilemmas. And maybe we're in a place where we need to take over a lot of ethical dilemmas that aren't being examined because of the... Right now, where are students going? Well, they're going to universities where, with few exceptions, they're getting a complete monoculture. They're not having a university experience at all. They're getting drummed into them propaganda from one viewpoint and all others forbidden. So we have these idiotic students who are at a university trying to ban speakers, the opposite of what should be going on at university. Maybe that's going to inspire some kind of hunger for a true diversity of viewpoint. And fiction that takes them into places that don't sound like they are all spawned by their professors will have a new place. That suggests a kind of sort of protest fiction, or because the extreme left at the universities fancies that they are still the protesters, even though they're clearly the establishment, they all have tenure. Tenure means you're the establishment. But, we'll have to call it anti-protest fiction or whatever. I'm not talking about conservative fiction. I'm talking about genuinely questioning fiction. Fiction that's skeptical, nasty, satirical, that really gets under people's skin. It's why I loved having a couple of pieces by Dave Overton in the first couple of issues. Because Dave just does that without even meaning to. He always looks kind of hurt and surprised when you tell him, this is outrageous. But it's still outrageous. you know, he still finds the hot buttons and he presses them hard. And that's a rewarding kind of fiction without it necessarily having a particular political point of view. It's one of the things that is kind of fun, but at the same time, it proves I'm a nasty person, is that when I'm in conversation with people who hold very strong opinions, it's just kind of fun to question and question until they get angry. Because where I get where they get angry is where their religion has been hit up. Even if they are, especially if they're people who claim they have no religion, they're beyond religion, they're above religion, just it's like a red flag begging you to come in and say, okay, I'm going to find your religion. I'm going to show it to you and explain to you why it is that you are just as much a religious bigot as any of the people you criticize. It's just that you're never around anybody who challenges you. You are only associating with people who agree with you completely. So you have no idea that it's a religion. You just think it's fact. But by questioning it, I can make you aware that it's religion. It's a belief system that not everybody shares. Fiction that does that job, regardless of whether you're propounding your own views or not, is really useful. There will always be a group of people who are hungry for that. The trouble is, and maybe this is what movies are doing, they've taken the name science fiction and made it mean a certain kind of expected experience. You know what you're getting when you get a science fiction film. Very rarely is it new, and when it is, it's not called science fiction. It's like Being John Malkovich. Nobody advertised that as a science fiction film. It was science fiction. It was great science fiction. The same author. Oh, what's the piece that just said? The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Absolutely, it's science fiction, and it's so complicated. It was very difficult to make a film people could even follow. People were confused by it, but that was great science fiction. But it wasn't marketed as science fiction. Why? Because in the audience's mind, science fiction is space or robots in the future, futuristic technology, not wacko stuff happening. You know. Those pieces by Charles Kaufman are science fiction by the Rod Serling definition from Twilight Zone. They're both excellent Twilight Zone episodes, done to extravagant excess. But what they aren't is sci-fi in the public mind. Wouldn't it be cool if we could redefine science fiction so people are aware that when they come to IGNS, they're going to be getting that kind of storytelling? Anything can happen.
Anything is good. I don't know that I would call it science fiction, and I mean, maybe that's just baggage that people bring to mind. I mean, when I say science fiction, it's a story that depends on the science. I love the Twilight Zone stories. I always have. I grew up with them as a kid, and I adore them, and I think they absolutely have a place in IGNS, but I don't know that I would call them science fiction, but that's kind of getting into a semantic issue.
No, but let's get into the semantic issue, because in a sense, you're right. I mean, the history of science fiction gives science itself the primacy. My problem is that where science is moving, cutting-edge science is very unfictionable now. What can you do with string theory? Because science fiction actually, while there was certainly science being discovered that was pertinent, it was really technology fiction. It was about engineering. It was about invention. But it's invention that was dependent on science, and it included a healthy dose of got to know something about the planets, got to know something about physics. Now we don't even try to explain this stuff anymore. And it, science fiction the science in science fiction functions as magic. In most, very little of it is true science fiction in the Campbellian sense, and that is because the science, the cutting edge stuff, is now so hard to explain and so hard to show how it impinges in the real world. But there will always be a lot of people for whom the real science fiction is just what you say. In which case, great. Let's find a new name for everything else. Speculative fiction works pretty well, but speculative fiction, even then, for one thing, it's a long word and it sounds a little bit arty and pretentious. Wish we had a name. Maybe sci-fi will just have to do, because I embrace that with that term.
I've heard people use the term science fantasy for things that are science fiction-ish, but don't rely on really knowing pure, true science.
That's a move towards subdividing the field further, and what I'd like to have people know when they come to IGNS is it ain't going to be your normal reality, but it could be contemporary, it can be alternative history, it can be fantasy with magic, it can be science, where the science functions like magic, the science fantasy thing, or it can be good hardcore science fiction of the old school. Any of that stuff's possible. It's just that what you aren't going to see is a New Yorker story. You're not going to see literary experimentation unless it's truly vital to the story. And we're going to have more characterization than a lot of the history of the genre would lead you to expect. I mean, when you look back at the old stories in the 40s and 50s and 60s, actual characters were relatively rare. And we're going to have them. You know, absolutely. You know, we're writing a different kind of thing. So what do we call that? Speculative fiction is okay as a name. Sci-fi as an overall umbrella that doesn't raise the expectations of science because the word science has been taken out of it. It's just the syllable sci is okay with me. But sci-fi implies that it's not fantasy. So we still need another word. What it is the kind of stuff we print in IGMS. It's IGMS fiction. but that would imply that we're the only people doing it. But no, this fiction exists, but it's hard to find a place to find it. Because I don't really find it that much in FNSF and Asimov's. I taught a science fiction course this last fall out of the magazines. And I'd done this before. I did this years ago at Appalachian State, where I subscribed to the magazine for everybody in the class. We read the issues. I got them the same day as them, so there was no privilege to it. I didn't say, these are the great stories, you must read these. We had no idea going into it what would be great. And that meant that they were free to disagree with me. I'd say, I hated this story. Well, I don't care. I love this story. But what we had to do was talk rationally about why. But
remember that point of view the next time we put an issue out that you see something.
we're fine. But the experience of teaching it back then, which was 15 years ago or so, more than that, there was a lot of good science fiction, a lot of bad science fiction. Teaching it this last fall, it was hard to find a story that was worth reading. I was embarrassed for my field. And I hadn't been reading the magazines lately. I didn't know what had happened. But there was a lot of pretentious arguments, but without a really good story. A lot of just dark, bleak, unpleasant stuff. Even in the magazines, you know, Asimov's began as a story magazine with stories about people you didn't care about. And it's become an arty magazine. You know, it's become almost unreadable to my students. And these were students who were open to a lot of things. Their minds and hearts were open. They wanted to love science fiction.
If they chose to take a science fiction class, absolutely, they must have some affection for it.
Well, some of them were taking it because they wanted to find out what was all the big deal, and some were taking it because they wanted to take a class with Orson Scott Card. I mean, that's, you know, they loved my fiction for my fiction, and they wanted to read science fiction because I was teaching a class, and some of them discovered that they're fans of my work and not of the field. That's wrong. I mean, they really would be fans of the field. It's just that reading the magazine, they didn't get a chance to see that. They didn't get a chance to see what other people are doing. Here's the funny thing. You know where I'm finding first grade science fiction still being published regularly? YA fiction, young adult fiction. Now, it's not because science fiction is children's fiction. It's because young readers are simply impatient with stories that don't tell stories. And so the writer knows that he has to stick to the story, make it clear, but still tell a really good tale. But you get really good work. You get, you know, William Slater, of course, has been doing it for years. He's one of the best science fiction writers we have, and he's almost completely unknown in the grown-up field, which is pathetic because, you know, there are a lot of writers unfit to tie his shoelaces when it comes to writing who would sneer at him and say, oh, he just writes YA. He writes children's sci-fi. Read it before you judge it. But there are others. David Lubar is one that I recently discovered. And there are a lot of fantasists who are doing things that easily cross over between children's and adults. That genre, that audience is not afraid to read things targeted for children, but the sci-fi readers, perhaps because they're sensitive about those comments that it's a branch of children's literature, sort of despise it. But good work is being done there. The audience for it is still there. I mean, look, I have millions of teen readers, at least hundreds of thousands, millions if you move abroad. I don't write YA fiction. I write adult fiction, and I still have adult readers. But the people who have embraced the Ender series are kids. Why? You know, that's what I want IGMS to find out. I want to find out what these guys want. Now, that's why we keep the magazine PG-13, so that parents can subscribe to it for their kids up 12 and up without worrying that they're going to be taught things that they shouldn't be taught. But at the same time, I have no qualms about having stories that are at that are definitely PG-13 and not G, because that's part of what science fiction's always done, is dealt with reality, dealt with things that other people were afraid to deal with. I'm hoping we can get those young people into what we do, as well as pleasing older readers who are fed up with how the field of science fiction has sort of moved away from the old storytelling that used to be at its heart.
But, you know, a PG-13 aim is safe on the one side, but it doesn't automatically preclude telling stories that, like you were saying before, have a little bit of an edge or challenge the way people think. I mean, the things that get the R ratings are things that usually are done for shock value more than storytelling value anyway.
Things that push you from PG-13 to R, with some exceptions, are really rarely necessary to the storyline. I don't have to see somebody naked to know that they're having sex. You know, I don't have to have somebody use the F word to know that they're a coarse character or that they're reading that. There are ways to get around that. So the PG-13 means you can be dealing with mature themes and sexual subjects and subject of violence and so forth in disturbing ways, but without pushing it so far that people are going to have nightmares and without, you know, causing social damage that pornography causes in the expectation that raises in especially young audience members. So we're making so that it's going to feel real. I want it to feel like these are real people facing real problems, real situations. And we're going to be experimenting. We're going to try some things that we haven't even had a chance to talk about, but that are sort of have been in the back of my mind all along. And, you know, we've serialized individual novels. You know that. But I want to create a series. It's the equivalent of a television series that you subscribe to an issue, you buy that issue, and until the next issue comes out, the new installments of the serial are in issue 2, for example, and then as soon as issue 3 comes out, then all the new installments of the serial come out in issue 3. But it becomes like Lost. In fact, the irony is that my son and I had a TV series we were pitching called Lost, that was the title, about an airplane crash in some unidentified place where they don't even know what world they're on for sure. I mean, really, it reads like a précis for this series. There's just a couple of things left out. But, you know, we never even pitched anywhere, so we can't claim that anybody stole it. It was in people's hands. But it's not a matter of stealing. It's a matter that that's the kind of thing I'd like to see. I have several TV series that I have pitched at various times in Hollywood that I would love to be able to have multiple writers working on episodes of, as long as we had somebody editing the continuity to make sure that it held together, followed the Bible. And I think we could get some great episodes. And then people would become fans of that series and buy the issues to get that series. There are things we can do. We can learn from competing genres. There are things we can try that the internet can do. For instance, we have an issue that we can keep adding to. And, you know, you can't do that with a print issue.
Yeah.
And if we don't like something that's happened, if there's something that needs to be done, we can revise a story that's already out there.
Or the audio story.
Yeah, that's right. We can add audio, which you can't do with print conveniently, and we can bind a record with it. But it's sticking in a comic, as we did on the first issue. We can't afford to do that every time because it's just so darn expensive. But, you know, there are lots of different things.
What do you think about the audio as the stories that have come out on audio? How have those been received compared with the other stories? Do you think you'll be doing more of that in the future? Do you think that lends itself to an internet?
I love audio. I'm not sure how it's working on the internet yet. Podcasts, we'll see. I mean, this is a new way of delivering it, so you get it all at once. You don't have to sit there at the computer streaming it. And if you can download it to an MP3, then, you know, I used to run with a small tape recorder in my hand. No way to, you know, it bounces right off your belt. So you have to carry it in your hand. And I listened to some books on tape while I was running. But, you know, tapes, it's hard to even find now. And CDs... Some of the technology would just lose your place. You know, you have to have something like car CDs that are built so that they
jostle a little.
Will handle jostling, and they'll keep your place in the book. You can take it out, and when you put it back in, it'll remember. That's what we're missing right now. We've marked this spot. But, you know, podcasts are doing that now on MP3 players. They're solving that problem for it. So it'll be interesting to see how podcasts go. You know, who's listening to this? Yeah. How many? Are they going to spread this to their friends? But also a way to make money doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, if everybody can take the MP3s and duplicate them, can you profit from it? You know, the shareware concept, which works pretty well for computers, for computer software, does it work for MP3s? I don't know. You know, how do we just figure that this is a medium where we do it for the love of it? We just do it for free. I mean, are you getting paid for this? Is there any money making going on? I don't think so.
Not a lot, no. Our primary site, we're trying to make money on, but it's still in...
And we're grateful if we get some money from any of our sites that defrays some of the cost.
Yeah.
I can afford to run Hat Rack as a PR medium and have only a few things that bring in money for it. You know, but the things that happen, you know, if people enter Amazon through Hat Rack, then we get a small percentage of what they buy. So money dribbles in here and there. We have a link to, what is it called, Christine, the place where we sell stuff?
Cafe Press, right, cafepress.com.
That's a wonderful, my wife is in the room, just not taking part in the interview, so she's the one who actually knows anything in our family. So
That's why men get married, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Or women, depends. You know, the forgetful one marries a memory. I mean, you marry somebody who fills in what you can't do. But so a little bit of money comes in. But the model that we want with IGMS is to have it be self-sustaining. And we want to keep the price low. I mean, we could charge a lot more. Other places are charging a lot more. But what that means is you're saying we expect our audience to be small, and so we want to amortize all of our costs across a very small base. I'm still hoping that we can find a way, and I'm going to be working on it, to see if we can just reach the audience to let them know we're here.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if I had 5 cents for every kid who signs on the Home Star Runner, I'd be rich.
Oh, yeah.
But how do you get that following? The Home Star Runner is a quick cartoon panel, you know, a little animation, very short, very, very kind of mean, but in a cool way. I find it almost unwatchable because I find every voice on it so annoying. I just want to kill myself rather than stay in the room. But my kids, including the adult kids, love it. And it spawns a lot of in-jokes. How do you do that with fiction? Does it have to have a visual component to work on the internet? Maybe we'll find out that it does and that the fiction model doesn't work. I don't think so. The audio model may be part of the key, is that if we can get people to listen to the stories, if we recorded them all, would it make a difference? I don't know. Can't afford to find out. You got to pay the reader. And then the last thing I want is to have the authors all reading their own work, because most authors are terrible readers of their work.
Yeah.
You know, I'm theatrically trained and I'm not great at it, because the art of reading for audio is different from acting.
Yeah.
You know, you have a lot of actors who can't read for audio, because look, the way we're talking right now, and it's deliberate, I could pitch this as if I were doing a speech. And as soon as I do, it kind of starts sounding more artificial. And it doesn't really work for audio books. What you do with audio books is you slow it down a little bit. Some of them read too slowly. You find people who are reading their stories as if they were reading not for the deaf, but for the retarded. And you just go, and it just drives you crazy when it's that slow. But if they read too fast, you can't understand it. John Cleese, I got Screwtape Letters read by John Cleese, and we tried to listen to it in the car. His voice is such a deep bass that the rumble of the car just drowned it out. We had to turn the treble all the way up, the bass all the way down, and then run it full blast to understand his words in the car. It doesn't make him a bad reader, it just makes it badly engineered, badly recorded.
Yeah.
So it's when you find somebody who really produces it well, it's a rare gift. You know, Stefan Rudnitsky, who does almost all of my audios, he's wonderful. I trust him to deliver something entertaining and well-acted for audio. But there are a lot of people making money at this who have no clue how the art is done. I had to stop listening to the Janet Ivanovich books because she had a good reader once, one time, one book, which was read by, I can't even remember the actress's name, but she did it in this total New Jersey accent that was exactly right. The author jettisoned her and instead has someone who reads a New Jersey girl who's a bounty hunter in a very theatrical voice. She does all the other people with New Jersey accents, but the main character is done like this. It's unlistenable because it's so false. Bad decisions just wreck a story. So audio is still finding its voice. It's a very different skill from radio acting, from stage acting, from film acting. And producing it is very different from audio mixing of music. You know, it's a different art.
Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to say about IGMS before you head out? I mean, places to go.
I wish I had something brilliant to add, but I'm enjoying listening to
Scott. When Ed came aboard, he immediately gave us a suggestion that we've always debated about whether to try to sell multiple issue subscriptions. He pointed out that multiple issue gift subscriptions are really necessary, and they are.
Yeah.
So we're doing that. We're setting up to do it, so that people can give the gift, and then it keeps on giving.
Yeah.
It'll help expand our mailing list as well. You know, we need to broaden the mailing list. Another thing that's vital is the goal is to have an ender story in every issue. No, it's not the goal. It's the promise that there'll be an ender story in every issue. And the first one's written by me, but the second issue came out in March, and I only put in my story in June. Can't do that again. We've got to have the stories right away. I have very sound reasons why it didn't happen until June. Part of it was that the story I would have written in March sucked compared to the story that I wrote in June. But it's, you know, I've got to overcome that and make those stories be such a high priority that they're in on time every time. Oddly enough, I can get my weekly column in, my review column, but that's because it's a no-brainer. I just sit there and babble. Yeah. And it's nonfiction. Fiction has to be better. It has to meet a higher standard. So there are things that we're doing, and those serials we're going to be working on. I'll try to scrape up the money to import another comic. I've got two scripts already in mind, but there's a limit to how much Orson Scott Card, even adapted into comics, people are going to want. It's just that my comics are, my stories are what I have the rights to. So I can do those without having to pay the author. Because, you know. But Ed is bringing good new ideas, and we're going to find things to do that will make this cooler and cooler. And someday we'll find the thing that hits, and suddenly every kid in high school is going to
want a piece of it. No, this is just, it's, you know, the one thing I will say is that it's kind of an interesting balance for me, because, well, on the one hand, this is the opportunity of a lifetime, you know, for which I'm very grateful. On the other hand, I'm aware that at the moment I'm representing Scott and that what I put out there, and so I'm looking at everything through a whole new set of filters, and, you know, well, I want to make sure that I represent you and your name, which is on the magazine, as well as it can be.
But the nice thing, I mean, as long as everybody realizes that when Eddie became editor, he became the editor. He did. And while there are things that I can jostle and you know, things that I can make happen, what I'm not going to do is sit there and try to second-guess his story choices. He's going to be choosing the stories. He's the editor. And, you know, he's chosen because I believe in that he will choose stories I'll be happy with. There's going to be times when a story I would have bought you won't like, and a story you would have bought or does buy, I don't care for as much as others. Well, big deal. You know, on average, we're going to end up with a magazine I'm extremely happy with, but it's going to be not Orson Scott Card's magazine totally. It's going to be Ed Schubert's magazine, too, and I hope he'll be taking pride in what he does because it's his.
Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Good to meet you.
Good to meet you. Talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Ed came up for the workshop that I'm teaching, Uncle Orson's writing class and my literary boot camp, because he just wanted to make sure. I mean, it was his idea to come up. He's already taken the workshop before, and believe me, I haven't learned anything that radically new since he took it. But he wanted to make sure that he really was remembering what my view of stories was, so that he was fairly bringing in stories that he feels that I would choose. So in that sense, he's taking seriously the idea of being a surrogate for me.
Yeah.
But that's why I felt obliged to make sure that he understands that he's also supposed to be a surrogate for himself.
Yeah.
you know, he's supposed to act like him. I hired not an imitation me to be the editor, but I hired Ed Schubert to be the editor. And by hired, I mean we're paying him in bags of dirt.
Yeah.
But he gets that dirt dug on it, and he can plant in it and grow whatever he wants.
That's so. Right. And when I talked to him earlier, he said he was enjoying gardening, so there you go.
Good, there we are, yeah. And so we won't even talk about the source of fertilizer, but go ahead.
Okay.
And there you have it, the first/second part of the interview with Orson Scott Card. Coming to you in a couple more days, I will have the next section, which is my questions to Card about his own books and his own writing. And remember, it's the story, stupid.